He is the second highest ranking member of the New York City Police Department. But Benjamin Tucker can honestly say he didn't grow up wanting to be a New York City cop.
The truth is, I wouldn't have aspired to being a police officer because I didn't like cops. I mean, you know, they used to hassle my friends and I regularly, routinely. You know, we knew what being up against the wall looked like.
Ask Ben Tucker about reform, and he will admit the changes are necessary. But defunding the police? Cutting $1 billion from the $5.4 billion budget, as some have suggested?
Well, I think it would be devastating.
This week on 880 In Depth, a frank conversation on policing, racism, and reform with New York's number two cop, Benjamin Tucker. I'm Tim Scheld from WCBS News Radio 880. Ben Tucker became a New York City cop in 1969, a time that he thinks compares in some ways to the protests we're seeing on the streets of America today. He rose through the ranks and then took senior positions in government, including the Human Rights Commission and Manhattan Borough President's Office. He served in both the Clinton and Obama administrations before coming back to the NYPD in 2014. The department was reeling from the effects of the policy known as stop and frisk, a police strategy of stopping, questioning, and in many cases, searching civilians. But studies found that people of color were being stopped more frequently than whites. A federal court found the policy and how it was carried out to be unconstitutional. A new mayor, Bill de Blasio, vowed to end the practice. Now, police reform is being taken to a whole new level, including new rules and laws on chokeholds, on police disciplinary proceedings being made public, and on the release of police-worn body cameras. Our Peter Haskell sat down with Commissioner Benjamin Tucker, and it started on the topic of reform.
Commissioner, thank you for joining us. I want to start with this police reform legislation that was passed in Albany. This includes releasing disciplinary records, banning chokeholds, an independent review if there's a death involving cops. What do you think of this legislation, and how will it impact policing?
Well, the state legislation, the repeal of 50A, it's been on the radar for quite some time, as I'm sure you know. But so what it does is it's basically been repealed in its entirety. We here at the department were encouraging some amendments to the original bill, but in any case, we are where we are. It's replaced by the provisions of the Freedom of Information Law, which requires our department to turn over disciplinary records. And so that's, you know, on that bill, on that piece of legislation, we will have to, we have to make a variety of changes for how we redact information, but also provide this information when it's requested. And we've already begun to get a number of freedom of information requests as of today. So this is going to be the future, and we'll comply. It'll change the way in which we it'll give the public a lot more information about our officers, but the department's going to have to nevertheless redact most of the personal information for officers, and the department may redact information that relates to technical infractions as well, as they are loosely defined.
Generally speaking, do you think these reforms will affect the way that the department does its policing?
Well, it certainly, officers will have pause. I mean, the 50A probably won't be as impactful as the information around legislation around the chokeholds. And so that's another piece of legislation that the state has passed, and that one creates, in effect, creates the crime of aggravated strangulation. And so an officer would, if found guilty of that crime, would be found guilty of that crime if they were to engage in conduct that specifically in the legislation says criminal obstruction of breathing and intent crime. So it requires intent.
A lot of these changes are about transparency, and that goes hand in hand with trust. How would you assess the trust between the department and the community at large?
Well, I think that, you know, the trust, we've been, since 2014, we have in earnest been trying to, on the heels of the stop and frisk litigation and then the appointment of the federal monitor, since that time, we have been very invested in training, retraining. We've retrained all the police officers in the department, all 36,000 of them, in investigative encounters or stop and frisk procedures. But we also, and we did that primarily because of the desire to really, you know, reduce the number of stops that were taking place. It was clearly, they were wildly out of control, the number almost reaching 700,000 in 2011. So we are now, last year, we ended the year somewhere just over 10,000. And so the numbers have come down dramatically. And that, I think, reflects the, you know, a reasonable number given the number of our officers and number of encounters that we have with individuals. And so there was in the Supreme Court decision that created this exception, so allowing reasonable suspicion stops, it worked out. I mean, the court did not issue a particular amount, or did not indicate a specific amount of stops that would be acceptable. It really has to do with each individual case-by-case stop, and that assessment being made by the individual officers based on the requirements and the rules that that was set and structured by the court.
I'm curious, if you're concerned, you try to build this trust and that we have these clashes between protesters and cops, are you concerned that that rolls back or reverses some of the trust and some of the progress that's been made?
No, it has. I think it does. You know, a number of things impact. You know, this the notion, as I said, we've been trying to rebuild trust. We restructured our patrol function to create, and so we can move forward with neighborhood policing starting in 2014. The purpose of moving in that direction was so that we would be able to establish and rebuild and build where it didn't exist trust with communities. And we changed our you know, with the reduction in stops, but also in terms of our outreach to communities, in particular communities of color, we've continued to make a concerted effort. Neighborhood policing, in effect, really dedicates police officers to working in the various precincts in the particular area or sector that the officers work, and now has officers, when they come to work, working in the same area, in the same sector, every time they're assigned, every time that they're working. And that, you know, keeps them in touch with the community. It keeps them in touch with both the citizens and the commercial establishments, but also keeps them in touch with and understanding the conditions that exist, and therefore gives them the ability to really work out those problems together with the community on the ground in those respective areas.
Do you think that made a difference during these protests?
It's hard to tell. Probably not. When you look at the protests, I think, you know, the protests created an environment by which, well, that was sparked by first the horrific you know, death of George Floyd, but the issues that the protesters are raising during their marches that still continue after several weeks into this are issues that are concerns that people have, and it requires us as the department to pay attention to what's being said, what the concerns are, and we are.
Important to this conversation about Ben Tucker and his thoughts on community policing is his own background, the story of growing up in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and how he became a New York City police officer.
You joined the police department about 50 years ago. Why did you join the department, and what was it like being a black cop back in the 70s?
Well, it's a great question. I didn't grow up. I grew up in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy, and I didn't grow up wanting to be a cop. But you know, I was in high school. A buddy of mine literally rang my bell one morning and said, "Hey, let's go take this exam." I said, "What exam?" He said, "Yeah, they're giving the police exam at Boys High School." And so, you know, I've been working since I'm 14. When I got my working papers, I started working. I'm raised by my mom, single mom, and so I figured I'll get out of bed and go take this exam. It was kind of insurance for the future, and so I'm glad I did, though. And the truth is, I wouldn't have aspired to being a police officer because I didn't like cops. I mean, you know, they used to hassle my friends and I regularly, routinely. You know, we knew what being up against the wall looked like and what it felt like. And so the fact that I actually joined the department was, you know, a surprise for some, certainly my friends at the time. But, you know, I needed a job. I graduated from high school had gone up to college in Westchester. And then when they called me, it just so happens that the department called me to come and be appointed November 21st of 69. And so I came down and took the job. And I haven't looked back. It's been a real challenge, I have to say. In the 70s, you know, the NYPD was probably 95% male whites at that time. We're coming out of the end of the 60s, which was a tumultuous decade, and we're just a year after the riots in the city and around the country in response to the death of Dr. King and Senator Kennedy. So, and of course, you know, there were all sorts of movements then and protests. So the closest thing to what we're experiencing today, Peter, is probably that year, 68, where we had the Omnibus Crime Control Act and all of the that came with that in terms of recommendations around how to deal with the racial tension that was palpable back then. And of course, the police department's a microcosm of the rest of society. So that was the climate in which I came into this agency. And I decided that for me, as a young black kid, teenager, I was going to be the best trainee. And then subsequently, when I went back to the academy to finish up 3 years later, I would be the best cop I could be. And so that was my rationale. And I came across all of it. I came across racism. I came across cops who were great at doing what they did, and that was the vast majority. You know, I had to, you know, make some choices about how I was going to conduct myself, and I did it, I think, pretty well. The only time I was injured in the line of duty was by another cop, and so that's the other thing I know about. And we had lots of our officers who were black, who were working undercover on non-uniform assignments in those days. You may recall a number of being shot by other police officers responding to a call or whatever. But in any case, cases of mistaken identity, you know, you found those officers losing their lives. So that wasn't a good thing. But I stayed the course, and I thought I could do more good being inside the department than being on the outside, and that's turned out to be true during the first 22 and a half years that I was in, you know, a uniformed officer. And and since I returned, one of the reasons I came back was just to be part of what I thought would be a moment in time where, under Commissioner Bratton, when he came back under Mayor de Blasio, that this was a moment in time where we could actually make some progress. And we have done just that. The amount of progress we've made in the last 6.5 years has been unprecedented, and in a variety of ways, And certainly crime is as low as it's ever been since 1951. And while we're having spikes even now, those spikes are, you know, we're still fighting the lowest numbers ever in robberies and murders and shootings and so forth.
And now this call to reform policing in New York City.
When you hear the term defund the police, what does that mean to you, and what is the impact of that? The council is talking about cutting $1 billion from the budget. What would that do?
Well, I think it would be devastating. I mean, we know. Listen, we have, you know, our budget is the majority of our budget, well over, you know, close to 97-98% of our budget is personnel services. And so that's, you know, that is really about the people. We have 55,000 people in this agency, and so the lion's share of, I think some folks think the budget, you know, if we say $5.4 billion, it's the number that's been out there has been $6 billion, but we're really talking really $5.4 billion, which is significantly lower. But still, it is, we have then, you know, a tiny percentage, 2 or 3%, that really is available for all everything else we do other than personnel services budget. You know, and we have a real need, you know, for purchasing vehicles, as you can imagine, also technology to help us operate more efficiently and effectively. Those kinds of things really matter. And so, yeah, if you were to cut $1 billion, then clearly that would eat into the personnel cost, and that would actually have a serious impact. I testified to that at the city council, I guess, last week, and that would not be a good thing for the city of New York.
We wrap up our conversation with the New York City First Deputy Police Commissioner Benjamin Tucker, where this latest chapter begins, the death of George Floyd.
When you first saw that George Floyd video, was your initial visceral reaction as someone who's been a cop and is part of the police department, or was it as someone who's a black man?
It was both, but certainly as a black man, watching another black man be choked and die right before our eyes, certainly that made it maybe for sure for me more visceral. And I have to say, but it had more to do with humanity and this individual officer. You know, when these things happen, you look at these things and you have all kinds of emotions. It's impossible not to have those emotions, and you get angry, and you feel disgust, and you look at this officer with his hand in his pocket his character is flawed. When you see someone who can do that and basically show no respect for the human being, that is troubling. And so, you know, you have a flood of emotions, I think many people see it that way, and you feel it, and it's palpable. So that's why the people are in the streets, and we've had our incidents, and we've had some, as I referenced earlier, where officers will be held accountable for some of their actions during these protests. You cannot build trust. We just can't build trust. I mean, people make mistakes, and we, you know, human beings, our officers make mistakes. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who sort of take this job, swear an oath, and then somehow believe that they can pretty much do whatever they want. So the burden is on us. And as I said, our officers are, you know, they are well trained, and when it comes to, you know, use of force, we are, you know, pretty much more restrained than I think most, if not most of the departments elsewhere around the country. And that's a tribute to, you know, I think learning our lessons over time, but also staying the course and focusing on tactics, importantly, and focusing on giving the officers the confidence to go out and do the job, but also making sure that they're well supervised and are willing to, when they see another officer doing something that is inappropriate. Our expectation, and it's required through our rules and procedures, but our expectation is that that officer should intervene. If it's a tap on the shoulder and say, "I got this," or something else, whatever that is appropriate for that particular situation, you know, we need our officers to step up and make those calls. It doesn't work otherwise.
Commissioner, thank you so much for your time and your patience. I appreciate it.
No, Peter, thank you. I appreciate having the time to speak with you.
In the days ahead, Commissioner Tucker will no doubt be front and center in the debate about police funding. We will follow where those conversations with the City Council and others go. Our thanks to Peter Haskell for this interview. WCBS 880 In-Depth is a production of WCBS News Radio 880. In-Depth executive producers are Peter Haskell and myself, Tim Scheld. Thanks to Marta Zielinska for our digital support in getting this content shared. And thank you for listening. Please, if you like what you hear, share with a friend.